Listeners, excited? Well, today we certainly hope to be cranking up the enjoyment a damn sight more than Samuel Tefera's own reaction to his world record run in Birmingham. On this episode, we hear from one of England netball's Commonwealth heroes, we'll touch on one of the most controversial subjects out there, and we bring you the very best of the news in sport. Welcome to Sportspiel. Yes, hello everyone, and welcome to episode 36 of the podcast. It is Sunday, February the 17th, and we are recording in King's Place in London. I'm here as ever, as it is my cheerleading co-host, Will Moulton. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm a lot better than I was last time we recorded. I'll be the consummate professional this time and not lose my voice.
That is good.
Embarrassing.
How is the cold? Has it now been consigned to the past?
It's still clinging on, but I'm in a lot better position now than I was 2 weeks ago. You'll be pleased to know.
Always good. But how has your last 2 weeks been? Busy in hockey land, I imagine.
Very busy in hockey land. Pro League has really kicked off for our teams now. Last Friday, as we record, I was up at 3:30 in the morning to cover a doubleheader, which was fun. And then yesterday, I was up at 6:00. So
nice early start.
And then next Saturday, 5:00 start for me. But it's fun. I enjoy covering the games. Hopefully, our women can get their first win next weekend. The men have had a good start, unlucky against Australia yesterday. And the women have had two losses, but their performances have not necessarily deserved those losses. I think they've been unlucky, just need a little bit more quality in the final third. China next week should be a victory, and that will get them rolling.
Nice. And I think we worked out just before we started recording that as you got up last Friday to do some work, that is when I was coming home from a night out. Because we've been celebrating, or rather having the leaving do, of the sports editor, Matthew Harris, who was doing all the South East and Cambridge stuff, and he has obviously moved on to Pastures New. So, a big night out for a big personality, and I won a bottle of champagne that night for having the worst shirt in the club.
What you mean by that is the loudest shirt.
Or the best shirt, I think you'll find.
Loudest, knowing you.
Anyway, what has happened since we last recorded? We've got another best friend in the Mintridge Foundation, who we've joined forces with to bring you more content. Follows up from our announcement earlier in the year that we were teaming up with K2 as well for a bunch of content. So can't reveal too much about what we've got in the pipeline just yet, but in the coming weeks and months, there will be some stuff that we'll be putting out there along with Mintridge. A lot of exciting ideas in the pipeline, I can promise you. Right then, before we crack on, here is what is coming on this episode of the podcast. As ever, each full-length episode is divided into two parts, the first of which is our feature interview. Today, our feature interviewee is none other than England Netball's Jade Clark. In part two, we will have our sports news roundup, followed by our discussion topic. This time, we're focusing on South African runner and Olympic champion Caster Semenya, after the Times reported this week that lawyers for the IAAF would be arguing that she should be classified as a biological male. All of that is to come, but first, let us dive into our feature interview. And to introduce his guest this week, it is Will Moulton.
Once again, Sportspiel branches out into new territory this week as we welcome on our first netballer. And as netballers go, there probably isn't one more better known or well loved than Jade Clark, England's record appearance maker with more than 150 caps to her name. She captained England to a first World Netball Series gold in 2011, has won two Commonwealth bronzes, and was part of that famous team that achieved memorable Commonwealth gold back in 2018. We spoke just after the Quad Series finished back in January, the exciting conclusion that where England needed to beat Australia by 5 points to win the title and only beat them by three. And we speak about a load of different things. It's a really great interview. We speak about, you know, hosting the World Cup this year in Liverpool, taking sport outside of London to inspire the masses across the country. She talks about how her and the team aspire to be role models and actually love to meet with the kids and everything like that. And she also talks about how her career in netball has been and how she's achieved more than she ever thought she could.
Okay. So hello, listeners, and welcome back to Sportsbill. And I think it's fair to say we've been very privileged to have some fantastic guests of the very highest calibre on the show recently. And today is no exception to that, as we welcome on Commonwealth champion, two-time Spotty Award winner, and England's most capped netballer, Jade Clark. So first of all, welcome to the show, Jade, and thank you so much for coming on.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we're recording 2 days after the epic conclusion of the Vitality Netball Quad Series, which saw England beat world champions and top-ranked side Australia in their final game. I guess, first of all, what an incredible tournament. How was it to be a part of that?
Oh, it was an absolute emotional rollercoaster. So much happened. We had that first game against New Zealand, which was really hyped up. Obviously, they've had a couple of legends come back, Laura Langman and Kate Kukura, so we know they were going to be a really strong team, but we got the win, and then we played South Africa, which is always a really close game. South Africa ranked below us, but they're a team on the rise, and we lost to them, and then we had to, you know, really rally around each other for that last game. What an epic finale it was. We had to win by five to win the series, so we beat them, but we couldn't get the five goals, so I think it just shows how exciting world netball is at the moment. Used to be just Australia and New Zealand at the forefront, and now it's kind of anyone can win.
And yeah, that was going to be my next question for you. I mean, in terms of the growth of the sport, it must be so crucial to have four of the top teams so closely matched and producing such incredibly exciting games.
Yeah, it's brilliant. The sport has never been so exciting, and the best thing is that the World Cup is going to be in England, so all our fans are going to be able to see that. And one of the teams that weren't even there was Jamaica. Just so at the moment, we had a series against them earlier on in the year. We lost to them, but beat them in Commonwealth. So yeah, it's just so unpredictable, and I think it's just great for the sport. It's going to be a great showcase at the World Cup.
And that game against Australia, needing to win by 5 points, did you get a certain sense of deja vu from a previous game against them at all?
Yeah, it was so close, but the lead changed hands so many times. So yeah, it did feel like that Commonwealth game final, and the crowd was going absolutely mad. And the best thing about the crowd was they were the loudest when we were down. They were chanting and getting us back into that game. And I think it shows how important it is to make use of that home crowd and how important that can be. I think you can see by our reactions at the end, it doesn't matter whether it's a Test Series match or a Commonwealth game match or World Cup. When you're in that moment, it means everything to win the game. And we were just all fully involved. And I was on the bench in that game, but I was living every pass, every jump that my teammates made. It was just a real great game to be part of.
And that game took place at the Echo Arena, and you talk about the crowd there. I mean, sort of a warm-up for the World Cup, where it'll be taking place this year. What's it like as a venue?
Oh, it's brilliant. We love being in Liverpool. It's a great place for us to be when we're not playing netball as well, when we've got any mornings off or afternoons off. We go into the city and we just have a coffee and relax. And so we love being there. It's close to my home as well. And then the Echo Arena is absolutely amazing. The atmosphere is so great. And we said at the beginning of this international season, we really wanted to make it feel like our home, because we haven't played as much there before as we have in places like London.
And how important is it for sport in general? I know certain sports get a lot of criticism for staying in London. The fact that you're actually hosting your home World Cup up in the north, how important is that for the growth of sport and women's sport in the country in general?
Yeah, it is brilliant. We know, the thing about netball is it's so accessible. It's played in every school, there's clubs all over the country, so it's not just about it being in, the big cities like London. We want it is played everywhere, we want it played everywhere, and everyone's going to watch it all over the country. So, yeah, that is so important. And we know from our netball fans, whatever city you live in, growing up in the northwest, I think that really propelled me forward and helped me get on the England team at a young age, because we love our sport in the northwest. And I don't know, all the crowd, the England games and the finals are pretty much sold out already. It's like gold dust. So, even though it's not in London, it's going to be a massive spectacle, and we're expecting sellout crowds for every game.
And your World Cup is sort of the final of a trio, if you like, part of Team Up Sport. You've had the Women's Cricket World Cup in 2017, the Women's Hockey World Cup in 2018. I bet you guys are now itching at the bit to go and make your own mark on British sporting history.
Yeah, I think we've seen over the last few years like how well women's teams are doing, and we're so supportive of those other women's team, and we're really itching to be part of that success and just keep propelling not just netball but women's sport forward. And I'd love to be able to like one day like know that it's going to be equal coverage in the media and on TV of women's and male sports.
I don't know if you were aware of this, but while the game against Australia was going on, your CEO, Jo Adams, was talking on Five Live, and she was very bullish about your chances in the tournament, stating that the side will be coming away from a medal, Yeah. Is that a level of confidence you have in the squad, or are you more taking a step-by-step approach and staying away from predictions like that?
Yeah, I think as an athlete, you have to stay away from looking at the end product. You have to think about what you have to do to get there. We're very aware that the top six nations in the world are all capable of coming away with that gold, and I think that drives you. And you know, I've been on the squad since 2002 when we started out and we were getting beat by 30 or 40 goals, and now we've come such a long way, and I've stuck in the game so long because I knew the single team was capable and I wanted to be part of it. So yes, you're always confident, but you're always wary of the threats, and you can't be complacent, and you've got to take it game by game, you've got to take it moment by moment within the game. So yeah, we're confident, and a lot of other teams are confident too, so that's what makes it exciting.
And I guess Jo's confidence herself was from what you did back in April at the Commonwealth Games. And I must come to that. For you personally, how much do you remember of the final? And if you do remember it, what was it like the moment that Helen Housby nailed the winning point? What was the emotions going like?
Yeah, I remember most of the moments on that day. It was such a special day. I just remember at the beginning of the games, I started on the bench and I was just thinking, oh, how amazing it would be just to step foot on that court. And I think that's how we all took it. Like, we took it as a huge opportunity to be there, and we didn't have any weight on our shoulders. We just seen it as, we've never been here before, you know, why can't we go for it, and why can't we get a gold medal? And then I think it was about a minute and a half before the game finished, the centre had cramped, so I went on with a minute and a half to go, and I took that last centre pass. So I was like stood on the edge of the circle when Helen got the penalty at the end. The time had finished, but she got the penalty. So that was probably the longest 2 seconds of my life. It went in slow motion. And then she scored, and we had that famous pylon. It's just so special, not just like for yourself, but with your teammates that you've been working hard for you.
So obviously you talked there about the pylon and the incredible celebrations. We saw the raw emotion. I guess for a lot of people, the Commonwealth Games isn't necessarily the pinnacle of their sport. But for you guys, it really is, isn't it? All the top teams are there.
Yeah, it's true. Like World Cup and Commonwealth Games are on a par. Like all the top teams are there. And I think with Commonwealth Games, it is quite special because you're part of the bigger England team as well. So all the other sports are supporting you. And then the special thing about World Cup is it's just netball, and it is the pinnacle, and for us it's the chance. Like, we did that gold, but we don't want it to be a flash in the pan. Can we back it up? So that's the next challenge for us.
And for a lot of people back home, you ask them to find the definitive moment of those games, and it is your victory by far, despite the fact it was on, I think, at 5 o'clock in the morning our time. But at what point were you aware of how much of an impact it had had back over here at home?
Yeah, it was a funny one because I usually like go off media during the game, so I was in a bit of a bubble. So I didn't go on Twitter or anything, or read a lot of the comments. Like, I always knew we had lots of support at home. But it was really when we were on the plane coming home, and our manager was kind of getting on the internet, getting a lot of messages through, and he said there's like people there at the airport are coming to meet you and welcome you home, and you know, can you go to the one show next week? Can you do this and that? Which we've kind of had really experienced before. So, and then we're like, oh my god, like so many people are watching. And then when we got back, we had an event to look forward to the next Commonwealth Games in Birmingham. And we went there and just speaking to the crowds, and so many people coming up to us and saying how they got up at 4 in the morning and they'd never watched netball before. So many men coming up to me and saying how much they'd enjoyed it and how they're going to keep watching. And then that's when it, like, those next that next month after we got back was really special, and we've had so many like loyal fans who stuck with us, but so many people that joined in the journey as well, and then finishing off the year with Team of the Year Spotty was just amazing, because that was all, and Moment of the Year, which was a public vote, I think that really hit home as well, because you know you're going against massive sports like football and boxing and things like that, so yeah, it was really, really special.
And since that victory, what have you noticed the changes have been like in terms of both participation of netball and attitudes shown towards you by people on social media and the press and the media in general?
Yeah, so much. I think we've had 130,000 people take up netball or go back to netball after that, which is, you know, stuff that we're really proud of. And you know, we know how important like getting back to your exercise is to mental health, diabetes and obesity. So I think that's, you know, whatever happens, whatever medal we get, I don't care if that's something we can really be proud of, that we're getting people into sport. In the media, you know, we've seen it on the BBC, like the report in the Quad Series, whereas usually we'd only report if, you know, it's in a World Cup or a Commonwealth Games, but we've seen it more regularly reported on TV, on Sky, BBC, on the news, on ITV. That's great, and I think attitudes as well, people are changing their attitudes. I think in the past people might have seen it as a schoolgirl sport because they haven't seen what happened, they've only seen it played at sport, but now that, you know, they're actually seeing it played at the highest level, so yeah, that's a really massive impact in Scotland games.
And I guess since that win as well, you and the team have become really inspirational role models for women, young girls and boys across the nation. Is that something you really relish taking a role of as well?
Yeah, it's something we've always wanted. Like, we work hard, we train hard, we're well behaved, and we actually want to be role models. We want to be out there talking to our sport. We want to meet the fans. Like, after every game, we'll stay out as long as we can to meet the fans, meet all the little girls, the little boys that have come out to watch and support. And you know, we've been there when there's been like a couple of hundred people at a game, and now there's thousands at our league games in the UK. So we've kind of seen where it's come from and seen where it's going. So we really do appreciate everyone that's coming out to support it. And we appreciate all the sponsors who are now like stepping up and backing women's sport, because it's a brave thing to do. Like, it's just great where the sport is going and building.
And when you heard, you spoke about sponsors there, when you heard that Vitality were coming on board and Nike were coming on board, what was the sense in the team? How exciting was that for you?
Yeah, it's so exciting. I think, first of all, because after Complicated, we weren't sure what was going to happen funding-wise, because we're not an Olympic sport, so there was the chance that we'd have to, you know, lose some funding and be completely self-funded, so... the fact that we've got funding again, and we like really needed big sponsors like Vitality. Vitality were with us before the Commonwealth Games victory, so that's really great for them to see us succeed like while we're with them, and then to continue backing us as well. We're such a huge sponsor. And then that was really like surreal, like something you kind of never really would imagine would happen. And going to the Nike headquarters and getting all your kit, and it just made us feel so special. So it's just brilliant where the sport is going, and now we're going to England training, we see the under-17s and under-19s all in the Nike kit, and it's just brilliant that they're coming to sport now, and they know they're well supported by such great companies.
And you spoke there about, you know, the financial pressures and the funding pressures. Compared to this time last year, I mean, netball has had a complete U-turn, and that's so well-deserved and fantastic. And but I just wanted to say, before the Commonwealth Games, were you aware of sort of the stories that were coming out on the BBC and things about your funding? And was that also a motivator for you to go on and push at the Commonwealths?
Yeah, I think we were aware of it. We didn't want to worry about it too much. But yeah, I think your motivation is just so sky-high anyway. But it wasn't the back of our minds, and then when we did win, we thought, oh, this would be what the sport has needed to like secure our funding, and then we still had a bit of a wait before we found out. So yeah, it was a really nice surprise, but not only has it helped with participation and media and everything, but it's also secured our funding, so we have the next batch of players coming through and knowing that they can train full time and like continue the legacy.
And that Commonwealth win, you've had an incredible career. As you said, you started back in the team in 2002, over 150 games for your country.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where does that win rank for you personally?
I think it's one of the best moments of life, like, for sure. The best moment I've had in netball. And when I look at it, it's not just about, you know, winning and team performance. It's, and that's because of the team that was there and the team behind the team and all the girls that were at home that didn't get selected. It was just, it's all about the culture. We built a culture for years, and it was that moment that it all came together. No one was in it for themselves. Everyone was all about the team, and it was just such a gutsy performance. And 4 years earlier, we had such a great team and a great team culture, and we came fourth, and we lost to Australia and New Zealand by one. But I think that's what made it even sweeter to keep going and to keep supporting each other and rallying around each other and not blame each other and just be so absolutely determined to win. Yeah, that's what made it the best moment. After going through all the hard times, you get finally get your fairy tale with a cherry on top.
And you spoke about the team culture there. I seem to remember a few social media posts about how if you won gold, you would get a group of team tattoos or something like that. Did they ever come to fruition?
No, we've still not done it. So we're all talk at the moment, but we are women of our word. We're all in different parts of the country now, so we've got to sit down and, you know, actually choose a tattoo and do it. So I promise it will be done. It's just, yeah, we're a bit procrastinating a bit on that.
And just going back to you, just to round off the interview, when you started out, did you ever think you'd achieve what you have in terms of international and domestic netball?
I think when you start, you think you know what's possible. I think I always when I started, as I said, I always thought, I want to be the best netballer in the world and I want to win a gold medal. But you never actually know. You always believe it can happen, but you never know if it's going to happen, and that's what makes sport so amazing. Like, you've got huge dreams and you just go for it, and you put your life into it, you put your career on hold, you put family on hold, relationships on hold, and you never know if it's going to happen. It's a huge risk, but it's one that I'm so glad I've taken, whether we've got that gold medal or not. It's never going to be a waste to try and get your country to the top in the sport and do the best that you can do in whatever field you are passionate about. So yeah, I didn't know if it was possible, but I always believed.
And that is the perfect way to round off a really, really enjoyable interview. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Jade, and best of luck for the World Cup and everything going forwards.
Follow Sportspiel Pod on Twitter, Facebook, and on Instagram, or go to our website, sportspielonline.com. Thank you again to Jade for taking the time out to chat to the podcast. As ever, we massively appreciate it, and we also hope everyone enjoyed. Moving on now to part two of the podcast, and it is time to do some news. For those who are new to the news roundup, I can hear the duck timer in the background.
Sorry.
Already. For those who are new to the news roundup, it's the part where me and Will basically get 2 minutes to talk about a news story from the world of sport. The ones that we feel are important. Some of you may have seen these news stories before, but some of them may have gone under the radar for the listeners at home. So we have 3 stories each. The timer is definitely at the ready because that was the duck alert in the background. Good to know that's up and ready to go. And I guess I will kick off the news roundup this time around. My first story is good news from the world of athletics. Yesterday, as we record, that's February the 16th, Laura Muir went and smashed Kirsty Way's 31-year-old British mile record as she won the women's indoor mile at the Birmingham Grand Prix. The 25-year-old Scott finished in 4 minutes, 18.75 seconds, which is breaking Wade's time of 4 minutes, 23.86 seconds. Muir's time was also the 3rd fastest indoor mile time in history, and it's perfect preparation for the European Indoor Championships, which are being held in Glasgow from the 1st to the 3rd of March. So put that in your calendar, everyone. There, Muir will be looking to defend her 1500-metre and her 3000-metre European indoor titles, but this is just the latest achievement in the career of an exceptional athlete who is only going to get better. 2 things, really, that I kind of wanted to pick out from this story as well. Firstly, the change in her mental strength. Prior to 2018, 2017, which is where she really kicked on, there's just been a sudden change in the way she handles herself on track. If you look back at her in the 2014 Commonwealth, for example, she was obviously still very young, couldn't really handle the pressure, broke down a lot when things didn't go her way. But seeing her on the TV yesterday, before she broke that record, so, so calm. She's literally the most collected athlete there now, and that's really giving her the perfect platform to build on. Also, this is, I think, the first proper year she's had focusing solely on athletics with her vet studies and a veterinary degree out of the way. So very excited to see what she does in the coming future.
Do you reckon there's a correlation between the two there, just out of interest? That her now her vet studies are over, she can focus more on all sides of athletics, not just her performance, but also how she handles herself.
I think so, yeah. She can put a lot more focus on the outside of the track aspect, because I think we always forget just how important the preparing yourself mentally is away from the track, rather than just getting out there and absorbing what the crowd might give you. There's a lot about the apprehension before you go on track as well, and she's really learnt how to control those nerves that she had in the past.
Fair enough. And you had 10 seconds left on the timer there, so good timing. I noticed that last week my stories were all a little bit negative, so I've gone for three fairly positive ones this week, and we start off with something that was completed just yesterday as we record, an astounding feat by the Sri Lankan men's cricket team, who beat South Africa in South Africa with the most remarkable last wicket stand. They needed more than 70 to win when Kusal Pereira was joined by Viswa Fernando and looked pretty much down and out of the test match, but Pereira produced one of the great test match innings, shepherding the tail, holding the strike, scoring a runner ball, producing 153 not out to win the test by one wicket. And what a remarkable game it was. And I think Faf du Plessis, the South African captain, came out and said basically all the plaudits should go to him for what he's done. Don't criticise the South African team. It's just an incredible batting performance, and it was. And it's what South Africa needed, because it's what Sri Lanka needed even, because they've had a poor few months. They were very poor in the Asian Cup. They lost 3-0 in the Test Series to England. They lost 1-0 to New Zealand. They lost 2-0 to Australia. Their ODI and T20 form has been poor as well. So they really needed something to pep them up. And this was the perfect result. And yeah, Test cricket is supposedly dying. But if you look at some of the series recently, England winning in Sri Lanka, England then losing to the West Indies, India winning for the first time in Australia, New Zealand beating Pakistan and the UAE fortress that has become their home, and now this result, Test match cricket is in the best place it's ever been. And one thing we're noticing in cricket across all forms is that the bowlers are now fighting back. Andy Zaltzman did a really good piece on this for the BBC the other day. Cricket is becoming a much more even contest between bat and ball. We've seen this in the BBL this year. We're now seeing it in Test match cricket. Test match cricket is alive, and it's brilliant to see.
You didn't realise halfway through your discussion there, a guy just walked past you, froze, and just completely eyeballed what you were doing. It was amazing to see. He was totally transfixed by what you were doing.
He also did the same to you.
Oh, he's the same guy. We've got an audience, apparently. That's what happens when you record in public. So, story two, or my second story, also from yesterday. We're very recent with our stories. So, this comes from the world of non-league football, as Altrincham FC showed their support for football's fight against homophobia by wearing a rainbow flag kit. The National League North side currently play in red and white stripes, but they decided to wear the special kit in their game against Bradford, Park Avenue, not City. Additionally, their regular sponsor logo was replaced by the logo of Football versus Homophobia, an initiative that was set up to challenge discrimination about a decade ago. Club director Bill Waterson said that the move was a big statement and a small moment of football history. He also added that the club wanted to show its support for the Football versus Homophobia Month of Action and also LGBT History Month. Obviously, a very great move. It sent a very positive message, and it got plenty of attention as well because it was on all the national sports news outlets. BBC Sport, for example, had a brief little report on that. But again, it does still highlight the problem that certain quarters of football does still have with homophobia. You only need to look on social media, for example, to see that. And off the top of my head, there was a recent video that BBC Sport did with Jess Fishlock about that whole subject of homophobia and how if you're a woman's footballer, people automatically question or ask, are you lesbian? Things like that. So it again brings up that debate and how there's still a long way to go, but a very nice move, I think, to see from Altrincham FC.
I think there's been quite a lot of talk about homophobia in sport recently, with the Joe Root incident with Shannon Gabriel, and also when the England women's rugby players Natasha Hunt and Emily Scarrett did that video.
Which was really entertaining, but again highlighted the point.
Yeah, it was so funny. And then on Valentine's Day, BBC Sport did the feature on Ramona Backman and Alicia Lehman, the footballers in a relationship, and Jiddy Flaherty was on there as well, talking about how she sort of experienced a little bit of homophobia in football and stuff like that. And it's something that we're more willing to talk about now, which is fantastic. And I actually think what Altrincham did was amazing, and I think they deserve so much more credit than they got. They got coverage, but not as much as they deserve, because what they did was so out there for football, but such a fantastic move. So all credit to them. So we are just a few weeks away now from the 2019 Formula One season getting underway, and the hype around that has really been ramped up in the last couple of weeks, with all teams announcing their brand new liveries for the season. There have been a couple of radical changes. Alfa Romeo have come in and replaced the naming rights anyway for the Sauber team, and the Force India team has been renamed as Racing Point. Haas have also had a major livery overhaul, going for a classic Lotus sort of 1970s look. Beautiful looking car. The talk about the season is really sort of starting to ramp up now, and I'm really excited about the season ahead. Obviously, you want the Brits to do well, and you've got not just one, but three, and technically three and a half, because Alexander Albon is born in Britain but races under a Thai flag. So there's a lot of home interest to look at. Big changes as well, with Daniel Ricciardo moving across to Renault, Charles Leclerc moving up to Ferrari, Kimi Raikkonen moving across to Alfa. Ferrari have said they've got a car that they believe will end the droughts that they've experienced over the last few years. Mercedes are saying that every team is a major rival. Williams have got a new major sponsor in Rockets rather than Martini. It's going to be a really exciting season, I feel, and I'm really hoping they've had a few major redevelopments on the way the cars are put together, the way the front wings are, the aerodynamic features. So hopefully we'll see a lot closer racing this year. We'll see a lot more interesting battles. We'll see more teams fighting for victories. And hopefully we'll see McLaren come back, because they've been abysmal the last few years. They're saying it's just the start of a bonding process and they're not expecting too much this year. But in Carlos Sainz, they've got a brilliant driver who I think is highly underrated. And also Lando Norris, who I think did a really interesting article about how he's not really much of a party animal this week, which was refreshing to hear. So an exciting season ahead, and I'm buzzing, and I've got 1 second left.
Ooh. Does your gut say it's an exciting season? Because I feel we've heard that for maybe the last 2 or 3 years, and it hasn't really panned out that way.
Last season should have been exciting, and it was in the midfield. It was that's the thing. Every season at the moment in the midfield is brilliant. There's some really close racing.
But do people care about the
midfield? But people don't. I'm a purist, so I just love racing, and I love action anywhere, but last season should have been exciting, but Vettel and Ferrari mucked up. They had the car to win a championship, but they screwed up. So hopefully this year, with Charles Leclerc on his tail, Vettel will actually step up to the level we know he can compete at. I mean, I don't think he's as good as Hamilton personally, but hopefully he can step up to the top of his game. We'll have Leclerc in there. Hopefully Bottas will come good. Verstappen, Ricciardo and Renault say are going to be as competitive as they say they are. You know, it could be a massive fight for the title this year, or Mercedes could run away with it again. Hopefully it's the former.
We will wait and see when that season gets underway. So my final news story is political, but this time positively so. New sports minister Mims Davis used her first major speech since replacing Tracy Crouch to call on major broadcasters to increase their coverage of women's sport so that it is no longer treated as a novelty. Davis also outlined her wider priorities and her belief that physical activity and sport should be treated with as much importance in school as reading and writing. Again, very happy days there. While there has been an increase in women's sport coverage, think football, think cricket, and also netball coverage as well, Davies wants to see a further shift. She said, "We've seen the popularity of women's sport on TV grow since London 2012. England's victory in the 2017 Women's World Cup final was seen by over 1 million people, more than who usually tune in for a Premier League match. I recognise the progress that has been made, but women's sport on television still remains too much of a novelty. We are still surprised, or grateful even, to see it appear on terrestrial channels, and this does need to change. again, very positive words that we both can get behind. But I feel, I suppose, the only thing political really is that it's almost lost. This message is almost lost because of Brexit and the furor, and it's literally the only thing we're focusing on a political level now. And it's almost like everything else the House of Commons does, or everything else government does, is just pushed to the back burner because it's not the main topic of today. And it's something I know we've talked about in our office, for example, in our newsroom. And everything else is almost forgotten about because we're focusing on this one topic, and have been for the best part of 2 years now.
You said the B word. How dare you?
Sorry.
It feels like every decision that is now being made and every bill that's coming into Parliament, they say, oh, we can't make a decision on that until Brexit. Yeah, but whatever happens on the 29th of March is going to be a process. I mean, I could rant on about it all day. It's going to be a process that continues forever. So how long are we going to keep putting stuff off for? But I do agree with what Mims Davis has said, particularly around the terrestrial stuff. I think Sky is in particular, and increasingly BT, have done some great work around women's sport. The coverage they do of their rugby, cricket, netball, WSL is great, but we need to see it on terrestrial
it's
TV.
Terrestrial.
Hiding it behind the paywall is not going to get... It's only going to attract a certain number of people to watch, and they're likely to already be interested in sport anyway. We want to be branching out to the girls who feel like sport is beyond them, that sport is not for them, and giving people to aspire to, and the only way you're going to do that is on terrestrial.
Exactly. I mean, like you can throw that wider debate out to having more sport, period, on terrestrial TV, because Sky is expensive to get. You add a BT subscription, is expensive to get. There's also Premier Sports now, if you want to watch ice hockey, for example, or
Amazon,
certain football.
Facebook Live.
Amazon, and you've got Facebook, and then you've got... It's just the whole, there's 11 sports as well, that's the one I'm thinking of, that you have to get a separate subscription for if you want to watch any sports on that. It all adds up for a sports viewer. So the more sport that you can get on a terrestrial TV, think The Athletics yesterday on BBC One, which gives a whole new audience access to a sport that they might not often see. And they could have watched Laura Muir's record-breaking run for free yesterday. Also the world record breaking run from who I mentioned in my intro.
You did.
His name I cannot remember. Samuel Tefera, there we go. Could have watched that for free as well yesterday. Skiing was on the red button on BBC. It just needs more of that thrown at it, and then the more sport you've got on, then the more people will tune in.
Speaking of skiing, my final story is of an incredibly inspirational athlete making her competitive skiing debut today, having only taken up the particular sport she's going to be competing in for the first time back in November. Rachel Morris is 39 years old and is today going to become the first woman to represent Great Britain at the World Paranordic Skiing Championships. She's had an absolutely incredible story. So she only tried this version of the sport, as I said, back in November. She only tried sit-down skiing for the first time in early 2018. She developed a condition called complex regional pain syndrome after damaging her ankle while she was on a dry ski slope as a teenager. Now, this is a very rare condition that causes the body to reject its injured limbs. And as a result, she's gradually had to have more and more of her legs amputated due to blood clots, which is remarkable how the body has done that to her. But rather than let that defeat her, she has become somewhat of a Paralympic sensation. She won gold in hand cycling at 2008, and then a bronze at London 2012. She then switched to rowing and won the single sculls at 2016. However, her rowing career was finished shortly after that, when she had a double operation on her shoulder, in which she was in hospital for 11 and a half months. She thought her sporting career was over, but then she joined up with Scott Mina, who is a former rowing teammate, who had become the first man to appear at the World Paranordic Skiing Championships for GB. Took up the sport, and now she's going to set off on this incredible new journey in her career later today as we record. So, a phenomenal athlete, and to overcome what she's had to overcome, such a horrible, horrible illness, and to just keep going is incredible, and I really hope she wins medals. That'd be amazing.
Amazing story, and again shows the power of sport, as it were.
To want of a better phrase, yeah.
To, you know, you're faced with all of those difficulties and those hurdles, but just something about sport often gives people that focus to ride on through that, and ultimately leaves them in better circumstances, no matter if you're doing it at a competitive level or a grassroots level. It's across the board, in my view.
And she doesn't just do it because she wants to compete at the best level, she actually has to do sport to relieve the pain, because she's in constant pain every day as her body is telling her that her limbs are injured, and she's got this constant battle. So actually for her, this isn't just, you know, getting more medals. This is a way of life for her. This is the way she copes with what she's got, and long may it continue.
Exactly. Anyway, that concludes the news roundup on this episode. Our discussion topic is to come after this very short message.
You're listening to Sportspiel, available on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's discussion centres around 800-metre runner Caster Semenya and the IAAF. Last week, the Times reported that IAAF lawyers will say that the world and Olympic champion Semenya is a biological man, as well as being classified female. It should be said that the governing body have denied this and said it is not classifying any athlete with differences of sexual development as male, that's DSD, as we'll later refer to later on in this section. South African runner Semenya is the most notable case and has been challenging a proposed IAAF rule change that aims to restrict the levels of testosterone in female runners. The case starts tomorrow, that's Monday, February the 18th, at the Court of Arbitration for Sport, with the IAAF originally intending to bring in the new rules on November the 1st, but it's been pushed back to March 26th because of Semenya's legal challenge, which is also backed by Athletic South Africa. And also, the South African government is on side. They called the IAAF's move a human rights violation, and they also compared it to apartheid. The rule change in question will apply to women in track events from 400 metres up to the mile, and it requires DSD athletes to keep their testosterone levels below a prescribed amount for at least 6 months prior to competing. This means that athletes with high testosterone will not be allowed to run for 6 months from the date any rule change comes in. By way of reference, the 2019 World Championships begin on September the 27th. Do the maths. Beforehand, I think we both agree that this is one of the most controversial. It's an incredibly tough case to analyse and deal with because there's so many opposing opinions here. You've got to consider both points of view here more than any other case I think we've talked about in our discussion sections before. But I'll start off then with a nice icebreaker of a question. Is Caster Semenya a woman?
Thanks for that. Yes.
Like, yes, I believe so. Yeah. I believe she is. It's this whole question of intersex and DSD. To clarify for people, she's a woman. She's been racing as a woman for forever, but she does have higher levels of testosterone than most women would have. And I think the argument is that the development when you've gone through puberty, whatever, because she's had that higher level of testosterone, that's helped the development of her muscles that a male athlete would usually benefit from, and that's why her performances are at the level that they are, is what people would argue.
But is it that testosterone that's made her the athlete she is, or is she just a very good runner who's dedicated her life to running and has worked very hard and is the best in the world?
Yes. Right, we'll bring that then back. That was the wider point I was going to make later on. First off, here's a quote from Semenya regarding the rule change in question. It's not fair. I just want to run naturally the way I was born. I am Mogadi Caster Semenya. I am a woman and I am fast. The ultimate question is, do we actually know how much of an impact testosterone plays in the development and ultimately the performance of a runner? Because there's a bunch of analysis, a bunch of research that says contradictory things. One of the quotes I'll throw out there comes from Katrina Kazarsis, who is the senior research fellow with the Global Health Justice Partnership at Yale University. Responding to that IAAF rule change, she said that the IAAF was blithely and opportunistically misrepresenting the science of sex biology, and it was seeking to create its own definition of sex based on erroneous beliefs about biology and gender. And she added that it's unfounded and cruel and will do even more harm by fostering misunderstanding and further discrimination.
The problem with any scientific experiments or any scientific analysis is that there are always going to be studies that contradict each other. That is from what I found when I was at university doing a sport degree. There's so many things that contradict each other. There's never that definitive answer that you want.
And any results that you do get, there's always an element of doubt to those results.
So back in 2015, the IAAF tried to bring in this rule on hyperandrogynous, which is another term that's been bound about athletes, which Semenya is one. But that was overturned after a case with an Indian sprinter called Duti Chand, whose lawyers found that the study they were basing that ruling on actually found no differences in women with higher testosterone levels than normal compared to women who had the normal levels. They then found another study before bringing the rule in back in, supposedly for November 2018, which has now been delayed. But this has also come under immense scrutiny. So that study found that athletes who are female and have higher levels of testosterone had an advantage in five events, which was the 400 metres, the 400 metre hurdles, the 800 metres, the hammer throw and the pole vault. Why the hammer throw and pole vault have then not been brought into this ruling is another case, question
only
entirely.
Track events.
But this study is also found to be deeply flawed. So Andrew Gelman, who's the Higgins Professor of Statistics at Columbia University, so very, very prestigious job and a very intelligent man, has described the analysis in the study as such a mess that I can't really figure out what data they are working with, what exactly they're doing, or the connection between some of their analyses and their scientific goals. If this is one of the key studies that the IAAF are using for this ruling, can it really be based on something that has come under so much scrutiny from someone who knows their stuff?
I think that is my overall problem with this rule change, is that it is based on science and research that we're not entirely convinced about. The scientific community isn't entirely convinced about either, but I think they've perhaps latched onto any type of analysis that's there as a sort of backing for this rule that they are trying to implement to make it more of a level playing field, because there are ultimately athletes out there who perhaps don't believe someone like Caster Semenya should be on the start line with them, because this is where we flip the perspective and the point of view. If you are an athlete, an 800 meter female runner on that start line, and you see Caster Semenya next to you, do you honestly believe that you've got a chance against her? Do you always have it in the back of your mind that because of that testosterone aspect there, you don't have a hope in hell, regardless of how much you've trained and how much talent you have?
It's not the thing is, it's not just Semenya as well. She is the most high-profile athlete.
There are
ever
other
since,
ones, yeah.
Ever since she burst onto the scene in 2009, this has dogged her like, throughout her career. But she's not the only one. So the Burundi athlete Francine Neon Saba and Kenyan athlete Margaret Wambui, they finished alongside Semenya as the top three in Rio, and they were three of the top four at the World Athletics Championships in the 800 metres the year after. All three have had questions about their DSD and about their testosterone levels, and I think a telling comment came from Scottish racer Lindsay Sharp after coming sixth at Rio. She said, "Do you burst into tears?" And she said, "There was nothing I could do. There were two races out there." In the same race, the Polish athlete who came fifth came out and said, "I was the second white woman and the first European in that race." That she was taking that as she couldn't have really done any better. I think an American athlete finished fourth. For them, you look at those three. You look at Neon Saba, Wambui and Semenya. They are just so physically different to anyone else on that start line. But it only seems to be a massive advantage for them in the 800 metres. You look at the 1500 metres, and yes, Semenya can compete, but she's not leading the way as much as she can in the 800 metres. So, I don't know. It must be frustrating, though, as an athlete. You've done all that hard work, you're at the top of your game, and then you come up against someone who's physically just stronger and bigger than you.
But then I look at their genetic advantages, however you want to phrase it. How does it differ to other athletes' genetic advantages in other sports? We look at Usain Bolt, tall sprinter versus smaller sprinter. You could argue he has an advantage there. Although your traditional sense of a sprinter is like a small, powerful powerhouse of an athlete, he has longer strides, for example. Rhys Prescott is another one, taller sprinter versus smaller sprinter. You look at the Paralympic side of things and classification, which we've talked about at great length on this podcast before, and again, it's a similar mess to this Caster Semenya thing. It's very similar. There's a lot of similar themes to these two debates, if you like. And you look at an athlete who has cerebral palsy, for example, and different levels of cerebral palsy, should they be in that same category as some other athletes? Do you look at a category where there's single leg amputees to double leg amputees, for example, and they're racing against each other? Does one have an advantage over the other? turn it to swimming. And I always remember an article about the body shape of Michael Phelps, who has got unparalleled success in that sport, but that analysed his body shape and how it was perfect for swimming, because he had it was essentially like a fish, basically, just the way his genetics had designed his body. But then should he be racing against people who maybe aren't so genetically beneficial or advantageous? It doesn't strike me as simply a testosterone DSD problem, because those problems are across all sports and across all of athletics. You only have to bring the Paralympic side of things to realise that.
I think the issue with testosterone that differs it from anything else is that testosterone is an issue in the other way if you look at doping and people using drugs to build up testosterone and other natural substances in the body to make them more competitive. Whereas in this case, you're actually talking about the opposite. You're talking about getting rid of someone's testosterone to make it a level playing field. And you've just got to think, if they're born like that, then surely we want a clean playing field. If they're taking drugs to lower their natural levels of these bodily fluids and these bodily resources, is it a clean playing field in that instance as well? It's such a difficult question to answer. There is no right and wrong answer, but it's just a minefield, and the problem is no one knows what the right thing is to do.
That is the problem. I mean, you could argue that this is the South African government's stance, and then likening it to apartheid. Are you secluding or discriminating against those athletes who do have that chemical in them naturally? And then you're forcing them to take medication to lower that. And then who knows what research is going to come out in the next 6 months, in the next year, in the next 2 years. And then suddenly maybe you're looking at the situation thinking, okay, we got it entirely wrong. What result? How do you deem those results that they've picked up in that time? Do you then take them away? Do you reevaluate them? It's just a whole big question. It's the lack of uncertainty, really, that makes me question how you can be so certain that this is the decision and this is the path to go down.
Also, going back to a point I made earlier, why have other events that were supposedly found in that study to have an advantage in if you had high testosterone levels, the hammer and the pole vault, why are they not under this ban as well? As people have said, it almost feels like this is a ban specifically aimed at Semenyan, Neon Saba and Wamboi to ultimately negate their advantage. And it's just, you're picking on three people and singling them out for being different, when I'm sure that's not exact. They just want to be recognised as athletes. They don't want to be seen as, you know, the sideshow or anything like that. Yeah. They just want to be seen as the best that is around, surely.
I feel sorry for them because it's totally out of their control. But they are the most high-profile examples of DSD, I suppose, and DSD having a performance aspect. And maybe the IAAF feel they're being forced into this position, feel that they're being forced into having to make a decision to try and make it more of a level playing field, to stop the flack that I'm sure they're undoubtedly getting from certain quarters.
If you were to also take it then to a man's perspective, there are men with different levels of testosterone out there. Are you then going to look at, you know, those with the higher levels of the men, are you then going to look at giving them drugs to negate their performance? It's like, where does yeah, the line stop?
Should a man with less testosterone be racing against women instead? But, you know, the questions could go on. Again, I also take issue with the 6 months aspect, as I mentioned in the intro to this topic. The fact that they wouldn't be allowed to race for 6 months and the World Championships are in September and the rule change is supposed to come in on March 26th. Do the maths. You're taking away half a year's worth, pretty much an entire outdoor season from these athletes once that rule change comes in, and they can't ever get that back.
But if they then go and win, then surely
that
negates the entire argument for bringing it in. I don't know. I just think when I was researching this and I was looking up articles and things like that, and ever since she became a well-known international athlete, this has been hanging over Caster Semenya, and it's so unfair because actually she clearly wants to do is race. And I remember one story that really irked me was on I can't remember the name of the website. It wasn't a well-known one, but Semenya's wife was supposedly fallen pregnant, and all the people were doing was debating about whether she got pregnant, whether it was Semenya or it was someone else. And it was like, really? Do we want to be talking about this? I'd rather be talking about Semenya as for her achievements and overcoming what she's had to overcome in her career with all these accusations and everything, and she's still winning, she's still at the top, she keeps her mouth shut and just gets on with it.
Of which there is a lot. You can debate the biology and the DSD side of things, but there's always a human at the centre of it. And the treatment she got, especially in the early days when the question was first asked, was terrible, on whether it's social media or from athletics management. And I know she did undergo gender tests at that time as well, and the results were never made public in the end. But there is ultimately a person who's having to deal with all of this outside of the sporting environment that's stressful enough as it is. So it's just, in terms of this decision, you'd have to be absolutely certain, I think, to bring in something like that. And that's where the doubt creeps in over the scientific evidence that we have at our disposal. I think it's something we've said before in relation to other classification topics. You have to be dead certain if you're going to make that that change and bring in that rule. And I don't think you can be at this moment in time.
But then on the flip side, as we've talked about previously, what if you are the likes of Lindsay Sharp, who you're at the top of your game, you're doing everything possible, but then you come up against these athletes that are just physically more well built than you are? It's
a no-win situation, yeah. Really, from all quarters. So yeah, don't know if there's any more we can really add on this. It's a perfect fence-sitting discussion that we've just had.
I'm just glad I'm not the ones having to make any decisions.
There's no right answer to this one, which is rare for some of the discussion topics we have, certainly in our opinions anyway. That's just the way I feel, is that you need to have more scientific evidence, hard scientific evidence.
As ever, though, it could have been handled so much better than it has.
That is true. That is it for this discussion topic. More is to come after this. Right, it is time now to come on to the final section of part two of the show. My favourite section, as I'm sure you can tell in my voice, it's Ask Alistair, where I don't know, to explain for the people and how the scoring system works and the pressure I'm under.
So every week we ask Alistair a sporting question. If he gets it right, he gets a point. If he gets it wrong, he loses a point. So having got the first question right in week one on the subject of Formula One last week, Alistair got the question wrong, so he's back down on zero. We also then ask a question to the audience, and this week's winner was Tom Radley, who correctly identified that the first modern Olympics were held in 1896. So congratulations, Tom. You are much more intelligent than Alistair.
Thanks. In second place, we also had Nicola Kenton, who emailed in, but Tom did get it first.
So Alistair, your topics this week to choose from: sporting venues or traditional sports?
Let's go traditional sports, please.
You're going to love this. Which cheese is used at the annual Cooper's Hill cheese rolling race? Now, do you remember when we were talking before we were recording and I said I was going to reword the question, but if I did, it would give away the answer? That might help you.
That doesn't help me.
If you know what area of the country Cooper's Hill is in.
My cheese knowledge is very limited.
Do you have much of an idea about cheese rolling at all?
Not particularly, other than, you know, watching those hilarious clips online and what have you.
Again, if you'd done A-level PE.
Which I haven't. Stop gearing these questions to A-level PE students. I'm trying to pick up on your area of the country hint. And the only cheese that is coming into my mind that has possibly got an area of the country is Gloucester. Is it Gloucester? Sure cheese.
I need a little bit more than that.
Am I close?
I need a little bit more than that. What have you given me?
Is it a town?
I can't say. I can't say without giving it away.
I thought that was cheese.
So what is your answer then? Gloucester cheese.
That's obviously wrong now, isn't it?
Can I give you half a point?
I'll take half a point.
It's double Gloucester.
Oh.
I think that's quite a good effort. You're on half a point.
Positive numbers, eh?
So now for the audience, your question is sporting venues. Which famous England sporting venue was once known as the Cabbage Patch? Send us in your answers and we'll give you a shout out if you get it right.
Yes, do that. Twitter, Facebook, email, Instagram, all of those things. You can get in touch with us.
And shout it at me in the street.
All that. Quite impressive if that does actually happen. As ever, don't Google it. Not that we're going to send the police in on you, but be a good
just
sport.
Just
and
for
that.
Your own morals, really.
Exactly. Can you live with yourself if you Google it? So, yeah, that's the end of Ask Alistair. I'm happy to say I'm in positive numbers, sort
half
of.
Half a point.
Again. More is to come after this. Okie dokie, that is almost it for episode 36 of the podcast. Before we go, some last minute messages for everyone. As always, please do follow us on social media. We are on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, for those LinkedIn people.
And YouTube.
And also YouTube. Not technically social media, but hey-ho. All of our handles are SportsBillPod, so you can search for us in the search box and we will come up. Do get involved. Next episode, we have been banging on about Six Nations specials for quite some time, and we did promise that there would be more in the pipeline. We have a date for the next one. It will be this Thursday, February the 21st, again conducted by Mr. Will Moulton. How much of a hint do you want to give as to who is on?
I can say that it's one of the stars of the tournament so far and another K2 athlete. Other than that, I'm going to be giving it away.
But this person has been in action in the Six Nations so far. So, yes, a lot of good discussion in that interview. We are also going to be back in 2 weeks' time, March the 3rd, but for a special, not a full-length episode, because I am on holiday in Scotland, and then I'm going on holiday to Canada. So I'm a little bit busy during that fortnight, but you will be here with a special episode and an interviewee that you have mentioned a couple of times already.
Yes, it's a story I'm really excited to share. As far as I'm aware, it's an exclusive for us. It's incredibly powerful. I don't speak for 10.5 minutes because they're telling their story. And that doesn't happen very often on this podcast. So if you just want to listen to someone else other than me, then that is why you should tune in. But honestly, one of the most inspirational stories I've ever told, and I had no idea it was coming, so it's a really special interview. Can't wait to share it.
We like it when we get exclusives on this show. But yes, other than that, read Will Moulton's piece on the website about sexism in punditry and women in football.
Not actually in punditry, but aimed towards pundits.
Aimed towards pundits. I worded that wrongly, but no. The point still stands. Read it. It's very good. Easiest subbing job for me to put on the website. It took me like half an hour. So
I just called a lot of people hypocrites, basically.
Which is, I'm always for that. I get behind that. But yes, that is it for this episode of the podcast. Do have fun, everyone, until we next return on Thursday for the Six Nations special. Keep tabs on social media. Do get involved, and we will see you very soon.